Hi, everybody. Welcome to The Deviant Mind. This is Dominika.
And I'm Christopher.
And sorry that we missed putting out this episode at the beginning of this week, but I unfortunately had to let go of my wonderful, amazing dog, Marlo Bubby Best. He's now running in the stars, so it's been a very difficult week for me. But hopefully this is coming out on Friday, March 17th. Happy St. Patrick's Day, everybody.
Yes.
As well. And we today are doing the Sarah Lawrence, I guess, I don't want to call it a sex cult, but it's a cult.
Right.
And Larry Ray was the leader of said cult.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking this is going to be a two or maybe even three parter. So we're going to go over kind of what happened and some cult behaviors, some definitions. So as we go through the story, that you can identify exactly how these kids came under the thrall of this man. And then next week, we're going to go over who exactly this freak show was, because he's definitely, oh boy.
Yeah. Incidentally, Dominika and I were going to try, because it's St. Patrick's Day, find a murder case involving a shillelagh or a pot of gold. But there are just no cases like that exist. So we decided to
do. Yes, exactly. And maybe we missed some. So if you have some, please go into our Instagram and let us know. And we might be a little late, but we'll do one. So
where do we begin?
I know, right? So I'm going to start. So there was an article that came out it was incredible journalism from Ezra Marcus and James D. Walsh at The Cut of New York Magazine that published this article, The Stolen Kids of Sarah Lawrence. And this was in April of 2019. And this really started this entire investigation. By the way, Larry Ray was just sentenced this year, January 20th, 2023, to 60 years in prison for what he did to these kids. But this article was the first thing that really put this out into the world. And also the bravery of the victims that came forward to talk to these journalists about what had happened to them. Because the story goes from 2010, September. Yeah. All the way to 2018. So it was a decade of some of these kids being under this. I mean, he really is just a freak show. Like it was.
Incidentally, one of the reporters of this article, was he a Sarah Lawrence alum?
I'm not sure, actually.
I know there was some investigative reporter that was also, writing and, investigating the whole situation. Yeah. But I believe he was also an alum and kind of saw or knew the people involved.
I knew the people. Okay. So maybe that's what it was.
I think he's one of the New York Magazine writers, but I'm not too sure.
Okay. Well, we will definitely put that in the show notes and let you know which one he was. But this, again, this is why we need journalists, people. Like people broke this story and really got this guy to go to jail to protect us from him because, oh my gosh. So as I said, he was this man, Larry Ray, was the father of Talia Ray, who was a student at Sarah Lawrence. And he was the leader of the cult, of this de facto cult. But it was, as we were speaking before we started recording, this was a cult of like 5-6 kids. So we're not talking like the NXIV cult or anything like that. It was very small, but as we'll go over, it had all of the indoctrination, the shame, but we will go over that in a second. So how did this begin? How did Larry Ray get access to Sarah Lawrence students? And how did these kids get involved with an ex-con on an elite college campus? Because this all began at Sarah Lawrence in a dorm room.
Yeah.
And it was because of Talia Ray, his daughter, who I know some people have tried to demonize her because she was essentially the recruiter. But at the same time, it almost seems like she was one of his first, well, not one of his first victims, But within this story, she was one of his victims because she had been indoctrinated by him since she was a young kid.
7 years old.
She was turned 7 years old. She was turned against her mother.
They get divorced. It's a really nasty divorce. And at one point, he just takes her. They actually kind of flee. And when they ran off, he eventually goes to jail for kidnapping and basically taking her.
Yeah, exactly. So she ends up at Sarah Lawrence. She's a little older than everybody else. So she kind of becomes like the de facto leader of her friends because they're all, they're all freshmen. They're like 18, 19 years old.
Yeah.
And she had always talked about her dad to everybody that knew her, that she called him a truth teller and that he was in prison because powerful people were after him. And he tried to save her and her sister from their mother. And again, we'll go into him next week because this guy is a full-on trip.
But she truly believed that he was locked up for political reasons. Like
that is correct.
Everyone was his enemy.
Yeah. Like, and we go like this guy, again, he has some connections to some crazy people. So 100%. Again, we'll go into that in the next episode. So stay tuned to that. But back to Sarah Lawrence.
Why she's a victim is because she was so manipulated and enthralled with him. And I'm sure during the divorce, that was part of the grooming process, maybe even a little before. Yeah. But she's completely a victim to the point where she believes her dad's a god. He can do no wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. He can absolutely do no wrong. So when he got out of prison, so first of all, she organized on-campus housing for her group of friends in Slonim Woods 9, which was a brick dorm in the middle of campus.
Yeah.
There was 7 total roommates that lived there. And pretty much at the beginning of their sophomore year, she announced that her father, who was just getting out of prison, was coming to stay. Which, hello, Sarah Lawrence, what the hell are you doing? So...
I believe he's 53 at the time, either between 50
that is
and
correct.
56 years old.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. 53, 56 years old, ex-con.
Yeah.
And he's going to, now, when the parents of some of the other students complained about what this man was doing, sleeping in the dorm room of these 6 kids on campus, this is on campus housing, by the way, this is not like off campus, this is on sanctioned on campus housing. They were like, well, but he's the father of one of the students. What can we do? He's living there. Like, what? Anyway.
Yeah.
So he moves in. He's sleeping in the common room.
Yeah.
And he immediately starts love bombing. He's cooking everybody steak dinners.
Yep.
He's getting expensive takeout. And he's regaling all of these students around him about stories of him being a government agent, an international CIA operative. I'm not even joking. How he engineered a ceasefire in Kosovo, talks about how he was in the Marine Corps and how he knew all of these big, high-ranking American officials. And so these kids, because remember, these are 18 and 19-year-olds, are like, wow, this guy is amazing. Now, mind you, he's bald and overweight and, again, an ex-con.
What's amazing is we got to give Talia credit for telling her housemates, my dad is going to stay for a while. He just got out of prison. Mm-hmm. She turns it into like an inch, like they can't say no. And at first they're hesitant, but then they kind of warm up to it. He's cooking for us. He's kind of cool. And like she loves him and we love her. So, but I find that really interesting that, if you're living with a few people in a dorm room and someone says, hey, my dad just got out of prison. He's going to stay for a bit. It kind of stops there. Like, I don't want to know how great he is, but I feel she has the same. So she learned her powers of manipulation from her pop because that's pretty manipulative. Yeah. Like, hey, my dad's going to, he was kind of against the wishes of the housemates.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And again, these housemates were, very typical, smart, introverted kids with good grades. Sarah Lawrence is like a very well-respected small liberal arts college just right outside of New York City.
Yeah.
And again, these are young kids. They're at this point 19 years old. And, he's kind of a very good listener. He took on the dad role in the dorm. and some of these kids were troubled. So before I get into this, I want to go into indoctrination theory and authoritarian control, because I think that plays such a big part of it. And so if I give you kind of a basic overview of what that is, then as we are telling you the story, I'm sure you're going to be like, oh, that's this, because this is how I came into the story, which I was like, how did this guy do this to these kids?
Yeah.
And when I found out this authoritarian, I'm probably not even pronouncing that correctly, authoritarian control model, which is called the BITE, B-I-T-E model, then it kind of made a lot of sense. And this model was derived from the work of psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton, MD, Louis Julian West, MD, and psychologist Edgar Sheen, PhD, and Margaret Singer, PhD. And they were all involved in researching communist brainwashing that was happening in Maoist China as well in Russia. And the BITE model is an acronym, and it stands for, B stands for behavior, I for information, T for thought, and E for emotional control. So now for behavior, typically the leader, the person, starts regulating the follower's physical actions by dictating how they associate or are isolated from people. They also take over private decisions like sexual expression, dressing, style, what you eat, what you do. So, you know, kind of really controlling actions of people, because now they are going to be requiring permission for important decisions. Then also there is a punishing for disobedience, and it totally discourages individualism, and it's all about conformity and groupthink. Now the I is information, which is again, kind of controlling information or withholding information within the group. It also, of course, creates an us against them environment. So it encourages spying with against other members, and then reporting people who are maybe are starting to get out of the cult. And then, of course, there is consuming a lot of the information, which is what we're going to go into, because Larry Ray had a very specific worldview that he started teaching these kids, and propaganda. And then this other one that definitely comes into play is using confession to shame or blackmail, and then withholding absolution from said confession to shame and blackmail. So T is for thought control. And so that typically stands for eliminating critical thinking, instilling black and white thinking, creating false memories, which is something that we're going to get into. And then also using stopping tricks to eliminate negative thoughts about the person, which would be like meditating, praying, justification, denial. And then the E is emotional control. So we have the fractionation, which is combining love bombing with breaking rapport. And this is a technique that is very typically used with narcissists. So it creates a need that then doesn't get fulfilled until the person complies. So it really puts you under their control. Also, the leader promotes feelings of insecurity and guilt. And then there's issues of identity and a guilt over things that they had done. And then it promotes fear of having the group's disapproval if you do something wrong. And he promotes phobias, which, again, we're going to get into. So as we're telling you the story, kind of you're going to hear like, oh, wait a minute, that was E or that was T, because it's just very, very specific. And he, by the way, has already started that, because he started with the love bombing. So he's now the group dad. He has given them steak dinners. He's getting them expensive takeout. He's having movie nights with them. So he's kind of bringing them all under his tent, and then being like, look how amazing I am, and look how amazing you are. I am just going to give you so much. And as before I went into the BITE model, as I was saying, these kids were typical introverted, but they also did have some issues going on, like all people do. So Daniel Barbin Levin was one of the roommates, and he was in the midst of questioning his sexuality, even though he had a girlfriend. There was Isabella Pollock, who at the time of her meeting Larry, she was Talia Ray's best friend. And she had gone through a really bad breakup right as he kind of arrived at the dorm and was really unmoored. There was also Claudia, who was struggling with depression, and Santos, who had dated Talia, and he was also struggling with depression. And his parents had said in this article that he had actually tried to commit suicide in high school.
And as we'll learn, his sisters get roped into it as well.
Yes, exactly. And his older sisters get roped into this. And
also, it's interesting to know, he apparently, Ray did study cults.
Which makes sense because,
you start off as a nice guy. Here's pizza. I'll do the dishes. Hey, guys, let's sit down and play music. But at night, he would sit down individually to express this notion of everyone's quest for potential, that everyone has the capabilities of getting over their insecurities. They can get over the feeling of alienation by just opening up, and they should start with him because they could trust him.
Right. Which, again, is a lot of self-help that actually is true. It's just you have to be very careful of who you're going to open up to. And an ex-con, 53 ex-con who moves into your dorm room is probably not going to be the guy. And so then I also wonder, did Talia Ray kind of again, through her manipulation, because she was so damaged by her father, get these very group of kids that were very susceptible anyway.
Yeah.
And so he made very big claims. He claimed that he could help cure depression and he knew techniques to help control the mind. And he said that, the Marines had taught him so much about control and how to be physically strong. And again, we're going to find out that that's all a bunch of bullshit, but that's next week. So he first started with Isabella. And Isabella, as we said, was Talia Ray's best friend. And she was from San Antonio, Texas, and she was on a full scholarship to Sarah Lawrence from an all-girls Catholic high school. She was having a really hard time. She had lost a lot of confidence after her breakup with her boyfriend. And in this article, some of the students in that dorm said that she was really fragile. She was going through a lot.
She had a poor childhood, from what I understand, as well.
Exactly. So he picked her. He picked her off. She was the weakest. And so Isabella's ex-boyfriend was actually quoted in this original Cut article saying that he had seen Larry reclining with Isabella on her bed and stroking her hair and saying, "No one's going to mess with my baby girl." And was already he said that he was really uncomfortable about that. And then he found out that Larry had said, "Hey, I'm going to start sleeping in Isabella's room from now on." And when somebody's like, "What are you talking about?" He's like, "I'm not sleeping in her bed. I'm going to be sleeping on the floor because she needs
a lot of help. And but since you mentioned his recent conviction and sentencing, Isabella as well just recently received 4 years for her involvement.
And that is correct.
She refused to break ties with Larry during the whole thing against her defense team, just saying look, you're a victim.
Parents.
She said, "No, I'm not. I was completely in control of what I was doing." So just to throw that out there, she was also.
Yeah. And she was still on it. Exactly. And so he started doing weekly therapy sessions with her. And within 3 or 4 months, which is December, so this was all happening through that fall semester, Larry called Isabella's mother and told her that Isabella was not coming home for winter break, that she had also been sexually abused as a child by a family friend. So remember what I said, false memories, implanting false memories as part of control. And that if she came home for break, she would commit suicide. So she was not going to come home for winter break. And Isabella's mother was like, "Oh my God, what are you talking about?" She had been very close to Isabella and knew that she was having a lot of problems. But she was like, "She would have told me, we were very close." And he was like, "No, she's just not going to come." Yeah. So that winter break, Larry, Talia, Talia's boyfriend at the time, who is not named in this article, and Isabella moved into a one-bedroom condo on East 93rd Street owned by Lee Chen, who is an old friend of Larry's. And this is where East 93rd Street is where all the damage really takes place. And again, Sarah Lawrence College is just right outside of New York. So it's on the outskirts. And so Daniel, who was the first person who actually came up to these reporters to tell them the story, said, you know, at the time, it was kind of hard to find housing in New York City. So the reason why he moved in was like, well, I got kind of into this, but then I didn't have a place to live for the summer. And he kind of like...
And he truly believed, you know, that Ray was helping him is the other thing.
Yes, he did.
Suddenly we start to see the beginnings of separating victims from their families. Yep. No longer need them.
Exactly. And then separating from students. So they're isolating them from the students now as well. So he's gotten to them isolated, no location. Now they're in New York City. They don't have any friends. They're staying at his friend's apartment. So there's also like they're staying for free. He's paying for everything. So now they are, what is that word? Now they owe him something, because he's letting them. He's letting them stay. And this is where everything starts spinning out of control. So he started controlling everything that everyone in the condo was doing. So again, that's the first step.
Music in the morning. That's how we start the day.
Blasting music. Yeah. That you have to like, the food was done at a certain time. There was like a certain schedule that everybody had to follow. He was still also love bombing them with lots of fancy dinners, and he would take them out. There was always a limo waiting for them to take them back back home. He so essentially the sleeping accommodations was that Talia and her boyfriend were sleeping in the living room while Larry and Isabella shared the bedroom. So very obviously Larry, who is by the way 53 years old at this time, bald and overweight, is sleeping with the 19-year-old Isabella, who was the best friend of his daughter.
I think one of my favorite moments was when Lee Chen, whose apartment this is, comes home. You know, he was always on the road. Mm-hmm. He comes back randomly and he finds Ray, Taya, and Isabella in his bedroom bed, and it freaked him out. He said it completely freaked him out. And he like ran out or something like this and was just like, what's going on?
What is going on? Like, what is this hell? So as we said before, he controlled what they ate, when they went to sleep. And also Talia's boyfriend at the time was taking antipsychotic medication. And he was like, you should stop that. You don't need that. Talia's boyfriend was so freaked out over the whole thing that he broke up with her. And this was the beginning. So, Talia obviously was already fully indoctrinated. I mean, she just thinks through this whole thing. She has always stood by her father. She never broke against him, even when he was convicted. And then, you know, again, Isabella is such a heartbreaking victim in this whole thing. So she's full in. So after this winter break, they all went back to the dorm and Larry started hardcore on the indoctrination of his philosophies. He started making family dinners, quote unquote, mandatory, as well as house meetings. And he began preaching this philosophy called Q4P, which was based on the supposition that all energy in the universe is powered by the quest for potential. And this Q4P was the brainchild of his friend, David Birnbaum, who is a diamond district dealer who moonlit as a philosopher. Again. So it's interesting because he takes things that are kind of true and then like puts his own kind of flavor and spin and manipulation into it. But again, this is the beginning of the brainwashing. He's also making mandatory family dinners, house meetings. There's shame involved if like you don't show up for it. These are 19-year-old kids, so they do. Now, this is around the time that parents start calling and being like, why is this guy living this, yeah. in these dorms? And in the original article, Sarah Lawrence refused to put a statement out and said, well, it was a parent, which again, I put a lot of blame on Sarah Lawrence. They could have gotten lawyers to get that guy out of there. I don't understand why they did it. Completely unacceptable.
I mean, so the school's been around since 1926. Interesting to note that it became a co-education in 1968. So it's like, you know, all this reputation, maybe they felt, you know, we don't address it. We keep getting funds and funding and we get more students. This is so small. It's only like a few students. Who cares, right? And he's the father. We can't expect anything. I guess it was also because, like, there wasn't – I mean, other than, hey, it's really annoying, this is really weird, there was no evidence that he was doing anything completely perhaps out of the ordinary, in terms of the school's view at least, to warrant kicking him out. You know, like,
well, outside of the fact that he's not paying for it.
I'm just trying to figure out where Sarah Lawrence would be coming from and not addressing this. Like, it's just really a school with this sort of, you know, stature, like,
reputation.
Why?
Yeah, right, exactly. And so his next mark was Claudia. She found the philosophy interesting, and she also started having weekly counseling sessions with Larry. She grew up outside of Los Angeles and was a real creative storyteller. She exaggerated a lot and liked being a center of attention because, again, she's a 19-year-old girl. This is totally normal. And I mean, just from everything I read, she sounded really, really creative and bright. And she started counseling sessions. And so, of course, when those started, she changed a lot. She started posting on Facebook a lot of things about the Marines. She also claimed to people around her that Larry had diagnosed her with schizophrenia. Larry was in no way, shape, or form a medical doctor in any way. And she really started changing for the worse. And this was around the time that Daniel, the other roommate, you know, he found it a little sketchy. And Claudia was definitely struggling through things. And, you know, I remember being in college my sophomore year. You're just, it's such a huge upheaval. Like, as we were talking about, your brain hasn't fully formed. So the decision-making isn't great. Claudia's from Los Angeles.
You know?
Yeah, it's a huge time. So having this extremely toxic, dangerous, evil force within your orbit is just...
But when you're a good manipulator, or a great con man, it works with that. It can work on anyone, especially if you're vulnerable.
Yeah.
And, you know, he would keep these guys up all night. You know, it's not, you know, Claudia would have a session.
Yeah, which is then sleep deprivation. But it would be
like a 10-hour session. These kids got very little sleep in this place.
Right. Exactly. So he really kind of urged Claudia to see a real therapist, and she refused. And she said, you know what, Larry is just helping me so much. And when Daniel started having problems with his girlfriend, he didn't know what to do. Santos, who was the other roommate, and Claudia were like, you have to go talk to Larry. He will help you so much. And so Daniel, you know, being 19 and confused and lost, we're like, okay, I'll go talk to Larry because he's right there living in this dorm room that he's not supposed to be at. So he went, and, you know, he actually was like, oh, Larry's advice was so straightforward and simple, which was dump your girlfriend and know you are not gay. And Daniel really appreciated his masculine approach and kind of, again, fell into having weekly therapy sessions with him too. And I think that's a very good point. If you're having these weekly or daily meetings and dinner meetings that are keeping you up all night, you're at school doing a lot of work, you're sleep deprived, you're being manipulated all the time, you just, like, it's like butter sliding right in under his control. And so he, again, was also invited to live at East 93rd Street for the summer with the other Sarah Lawrence kids. And Daniel went on record saying that, you know, at the time it was housing in New York and Larry was helping him. Right. So he agreed to stay there for the summer.
I got to say, of everyone that was there, I think it's safe to say, while everyone obviously was having emotional and mental abuse, he probably received the most physical abuse of the mm-hmm. folks that were all living together in that.
Well, except for Santos, because there was like, wasn't Santos the was one with the
like he was
scrotum garrote?
You know,
he was. Yeah. Yeah. We'll get to that.
Boy.
We'll get to that. So for the summer at East 93rd Street, there was Daniel, Talia, Claudia, mm-hmm. Isabella, and Santos. They were all living there, and it was kind of almost an extension of the college dorm room. They were having family dinners, and again, the very long discussions into the night. They also were getting a lot of expensive gifts from Larry. They were getting clothes. They were getting expensive dinners. He would take them to these extravagant steak restaurants. He obviously very much liked the steak. And then he always had a wad of cash with him that he kept in a backpack that he took with him everywhere. And he had a limo on reserve that would take the kids anywhere at all time of the night, which again, especially if some of these kids maybe weren't coming from rich families, it's like, oh, here's, you know, I'm being taken care of. Like I'm getting food and he's making sure that I'm safe getting home at night. Because East 93rd Street, isn't that in Spanish Harlem?
It's kind of the beginning of Spanish Harlem. Yeah, the higher
the beginning
you go,
of Spanish
then it becomes,
Okay.
I'm very close.
So he was claiming that the money was coming to him from being a life consultant to a wealthy friend. And then he started a domain name business, which he made the kids help him with. And I believe his domain name business was he would buy domain names and park them and then charge people a lot of money to essentially buy them off of him.
That was a very big thing at the time. And it still is, I guess, you know?
Yeah. And so this is like at this point, 2011? And unfortunately, this is where the confessions and shame and false memories come in. So he would have nightly meetings. This is every night of this core work that he was supposedly teaching these kids to be their best selves. But he would put one of these kids in a hot seat
in front
and grill
them
for
in front of the
hours
others. It's like
through
a group
night.
Session.
It's a group session, exactly. And typically the person who would be put in the hot seat was somebody who did something that Larry didn't like. Because at this point, Larry had full-on control over things that the kids were doing inside of the apartment and blaming them for if somebody scratched a pan or broke a plate or if something happened to the knob or if there was something into the bathroom. He would create these very long lists of everything that the kids had supposedly, quote unquote, messed up in the house with monetary values and saying, okay, now you owe me like $30,000 for breaking this and this and this. And at this point, he had broken the kids down so much that they were like, I owe him $30,000. They were calling
the parents
to give them money. And the parents paid. One of the parents paid over $200,000 to Larry for things supposedly broken in this apartment.
The Santos family had a store. They sold the store to get the money to give to Ray. So, you know, Santos was falsely accused, obviously. But then he took full responsibility and just felt lousy. Felt he was doing his, his spiritual guide, coach along. But, you know, what's really crazy is you have instances where, Daniel, now you're having girl issues. And then it became, Isabella, why don't you make love to Daniel? Why don't you kiss him right now? And it's happening in front of everyone in the group. And that's supposed to help Daniel. Then there was another time apparently where he forced Daniel to wear a dress. And one of the members was asked to forcibly have him use a sex toy. So it's all this confusing, like he's already having issues. He broke up with his girlfriend. He's having issues with his sexuality. They're all preyed upon, but now it's done in front of one another.
Yeah. and the full on shame, which means then like now you're going to have the, you know, shame and judgment of your people. It also makes you feel so indebted to these people, right? Now they know your like deepest, darkest secrets, like where are you going to go? And they can tell people like, oh my God, you know, he did this. And there was actually one example that was in that Cut article about, and this is where the planting of the false memories come. So Daniel was in the hot seat for doing something, and he was supposedly, he really liked playing the ukulele. And it ended up after hours and hours of discussion that he played the ukulele because his father inflicted trauma on him. So Larry had him smash the instrument in front of the group as closure. And he said that he had immense pressure to find explanations for any of his actions. And part of Larry's philosophy was that any small mistake that was created in this apartment, like again, the scratching of a plate, was a sign of childhood trauma. And this was around the time that he started blaming the kids for essentially trying to sabotage his program, now hit this self-help program, by essentially breaking things into the apartment. And then he also accused them of trying to harm his family. So,
and also while this is going on,
there was,
he wants to do apartment repairs to an apartment that's not even his. And so he's having the kids do all this handyman work and, you know, spackling and building new shelving units. And that's yet another reason. That's yet another, you know, path for him to take to blame them for stuff. You know, you did this improperly. Do you know how much damage you just did to this wall? And it's that's the best part is it's Lee Chen's apartment. It's just like, wow.
And he's like, he's complete dismantling it and then putting it back together the wrong way. And these kids, of course, have no construction know-how at all. And so they're doing construction during the day. They're having like their sleep taken away from them at night. They're also having to explore any subversive behavior that Larry deems subversive. And they have to write it down in painstaking detail. And then they require written signed confessions for this. So again, going back to that bite model, we're going through that. And Santos fully believed that he was interfering with Larry's business. And this was around the time that he was getting his parents to give him all this money. Cause then all of a sudden it became this like weird grievance thing that anything that these kids did was them essentially trying to hurt Larry and his family, which I guess included Thalia, which there is actually a pyramid of cults where they have the leader is on the like tip top point, and then the lieutenant is right next to them. And then it goes down to, you know, kind of the general milieu, as it were. And even though this is a very small cult of 5-6 kids, you already have the kind of levels, right? So you have Larry on top, you have Thalia as his daughter. So now the other members, whenever they mess something up in the apartment, they are now going against Thalia and Larry. And then Isabella kind of goes up to that level as well. And Daniel and Santos, and then Santos brought his older sisters in, Yalitza and Felicia, in the fall. And now, mind you, as I was doing this research, Daniel and Claudia had actually gone away for the semester, and he still managed to get to them by making them do Skype calls. So they were gone the whole semester, and he kept them in the cult by essentially doing these sessions. He was also, I mean, you know, bringing sex into this. So he had Isabella and Daniel doing weekly sessions of sex while he watched, while he essentially directed them. So if you remember the bite model saying that take away the decision making for very private matters. So this is us, you know, making the decision to take away from these kids. Like, okay, you're going to have sex, and I'm going to tell you step by
it's
step
really
how you should have sex
doctors
with
came
each
up
other.
With this bite model. I mean, so far from the top when you were describing it, everything is fitting into place.
It's just, it's like clicks in.
There's a little background to Felicia. you know, the Santos' sisters. She, at the time, it's important to know, was on her, she was doing residency. She wanted to become a doctor.
Yeah.
So I'll let you take it from there.
Yeah. And she was, but we'll get to them in a second. But so essentially, again, the exploitation of these kids, Larry joined in having sex with Isabel and Danielle. And then he even had Shen, the owner of the condo, help. So apparently Larry Chen got over his like, oh my God, what's happening? Because he was actually, I guess, having a foursome with Isabella, Daniel, and Larry at some point. And then once Daniel and Claudia left, Larry started making them have sex together on those Skype calls. So again, now he's controlling them and their personal decisions as well. So he was coaching them, which again,
no matter
to me,
where
is
they are,
just...
they could be anywhere. They could be abroad for the next semester. He's still going to be on top of them.
Yeah. And he's still, and now, so Santos and his family, this was like, again, just heartbreaking because I also feel like this Italian white dude had totally took control of these kids who were from, you know, other countries. So Santos' family came from the Dominican Republic to the Bronx in the early 1980s. His parents had emigrated there and they operated a small travel agency and a grocery store in Washington Heights. And they had managed to save enough money to buy a home in the Bronx. And they managed, and again, this was amazing, managed to get their kids into like the best schools in the country. Yalitza was an undergrad at Columbia when she first started visiting that apartment on 93rd Street. And Felicia, who was the oldest, she was a Harvard graduate with a medical degree from Columbia. I mean, holy hell, like this is literally the American dream. And she was in her residency in Los Angeles when Larry started calling her regularly. And
he Isabella.
Oh, and he managed to and he managed to get her to essentially she just abandoned her residency program and moved in with him. And this is a girl who went to Harvard and Columbia Medical School. Like, I just, when I read that, I was like, what is happening here? Yeah, like, how did he do this?
That's real power. I mean, to sway someone completely from their goals in life. Wow. Yes.
And long distance. Because she was in Los Angeles and he was in New York. Like, that to me is like, what the fuck is happening here? This is why I went down the rabbit hole of finding out, like, how do you get indoctrinated into a cult? And so then it was like, okay, you can kind of, like, see what it is. And, you know, the moment she arrived in New York, they started having a romantic relationship and talked about marriage and having children together. And Larry both referred to both Felicia and Isabella as his wife. Now, again, these women are in their, like, you know, early 20s. He's 50, 55 at this point, fat, bald. I mean, you should see pictures of this guy, people. Like, this is not some handsome Svengali type. This is, like, a past middle-aged, fat, like, I just, no. It just really was shocking to me. But again, he, as we will go in next week, he had a very long history of manipulating women. I mean, this guy was such a master manipulator that the first time he went to jail, they had psychiatrists try to figure out what the hell he was. And one of the psychiatrists said that he lied so much. He's like, there is no way I can diagnose this guy. I can't do it. I can't do it. Now, I did find an article after this latest conviction here in 2023 that he had been diagnosed with histrionic and narcissistic personality disorder. And then, you know, this is obviously he's like a full on malignant narcissist. But so everybody's now at this point living on East 93rd Street. So there's a bunch of people living in there. Now, Daniel kind of realized that around this time, this was very wrong. And he, after the whole dildo incident that you mentioned, he was so horrified and cried that he found the courage to leave. He acquired on-campus housing in 2013 in the spring semester, and he stopped responding to any phone calls from anybody who lived in that apartment. He got back together with his parents. Now, mind you, we haven't actually talked a lot about the violence that Larry showed to these kids
also
as well.
Also important to note is that he's filming so much from their confessions, from just from the violence. He films the violence. He's literally, I mean, it's all evidence to be used later. That's what's...
Which, again, it is all used as evidence in his trial. This is why he got 60 years in prison, because it was
all documented.
It was all documented, all on video, and it actually helped some of these survivors get, what is it, decommissioned? No, when you come out of a cult, you have to be deprogrammed. So it helped some of these survivors be deprogrammed because of these videos as well. But this was actually, so he said that he, Larry Chen, who was back in 2019, was interviewed by these reporters, said that Larry would regularly abuse Santos. And that he would put the 20-year-old in sleeper holds until he passed out. He would ask, did the darkness envelop you when Santos woke up? And then once, apparently, Daniel supposedly damaged the oven. So Larry asked him to kneel and then stood over him with a knife and threatened to dismember him. So then you have the fear and the retribution for all of these wrongdoings coming into these. And again, these are like 19-year-old kids being completely manipulated. Daniel said, I was fully prepared to be dismembered at this point. But like, I mean, literally thought this
Daniel
guy was going
also
to
went
kill
through
me.
Is just shocking. And again, this is all on video, folks. Like this, you know, all this abuse is documented one way or another. You know, you literally see moving images of Larry Ray holding Daniel's tongue in a vice, like in a wrench, threatening to rip out his tongue. I mean, it's, but then again, he has it on video so he can hang it over the kid. I don't know what it is. Like, I don't know what his intent is with all these videos.
Well, it is, I mean, and that goes back to that control, which is the bite model. Like when I was, you know, doing research for this, I was like, like, how are these kids so broken so quickly? This took like a year and a half.
It's their age.
Tops.
It's their age.
But because it's their age, but it's also a very systematic breaking down of self, which was very helpful when finding that bite model, being like, oh, okay, so you're breaking down the thinking, you're isolating, you're then breaking down the emotions, then you're using fear to the point, like, you know, I couldn't understand. There was something in the article, they gave an example of these supposed damages that were happened, right? That, so he would either claim that things were stolen from him, or that there were ruined things of value and therefore they owed money. So Santos showed an email saying prices of things that I damaged ruined. And it was 5 pages accounting for more than 50 items ranging from painting tape to a gas range. And the total was $47,000. And so again, this was Santos turned to his parents and said, I'm going to commit suicide if you do not pay this. Yeah. And so as parents, right, who have gone through so much or like, well, I don't want you to lose you, of course, we'll pay. And, you know, Santos's parents gave the money just because they were
the money,
so afraid
in most cases, we're still unable
Santos
to speak
taking
with
his
them.
Own life.
So they would get an occasional call. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're but never hearing from your son. All of a sudden he's calling saying, I need the $47,000. He gets it. And then again, they can't speak with him.
Yeah. And now, so this is not just happening to Santos, but this is also happening to Claudia, Yalitza, and Isabella as well. So they start asking their friends and family for money, saying that they damaged Larry's property. And there was this whole issue where Larry took all of the kids to his stepfather's house in Pinehurst, North Carolina, and had them doing like major construction on them, on the house. And there's video say like the kids crying because they're, he's making for them hours. Like do plumbing in the middle of the night that they don't know how to do. And then mind you, the parents, they can't get them out. These are all supposedly adults. The Santos's parents went to the NYPD 3 times with the story, and the police told them there wasn't much that they could be done because all of the kids were over the age of 18. Claudia's parents also alerted the police, and they did the same thing. In 2017, the police conducted a wellness check on Claudia and determined that she was acting from her own free will because, again, these kids are on a cult. And they're like, this is all happening. It's true. I stole something. Like, they're so brainwashed, they actually believe that they stole things from him and broke things, and now they owe him so much money.
I was just going to say, and then now, you think about the funny – there was a 5-year reunion of their class at Sarah Lawrence. So everyone obviously except them, all the students, that's the topic of the entire reunion. Just everyone's talking about this. Like, what happened to them? They were so cool. They were so nice. Have you heard from them? I haven't heard from them. So imagine that. You go to your 5-year reunion, and it's just kind of like, wow, that was weird. But now it's weirder. Like, the fact that, like, he was here, now there, none of them are here, you know? So I find that really interesting. Like, it really shook the town. It really shook the students.
Yeah, it did. And now, of course, along with mind control comes like this dissonance in your mind. So Yalitza's parents got a call in 2013 from Mount Sinai because she had tried to commit suicide by swallowing a bottle of Tylenol and was in a coma. But she was transferred to a hospital in White Plains, and her parents were visiting her every day. And then one day, the security wouldn't let them into their daughter's room. And they said, we wanted to meet with Yalitza's doctor.
Yeah.
And they said, Larry's here. Larry's present. And Yalitza claimed that Larry was the one that examined her in a coma, looked at their lab results, and made suggestions to her medical team, and he saved her life. So she was, again, not speaking to her parents, which these poor parents, I can't even imagine losing 3 children to this insane monster, not being able to go to the hospital, not being able to, and then having to sell their house that they worked so hard on because they were so afraid to lose their children. And he took close to over $200,000 from them, and the NYPD couldn't do anything about it. Unfortunately, Claudia was also rushed to Mount Sinai in 2014. She also swallowed a bottle of Tylenol, and Claudia would only talk to Larry, not to them. And, now, according to family and friends, only Santos was the one who tried to like kill himself before Larry. But then after that, both Isabella, Yalitza, and Claudia had all attempted suicide. And Larry later estimated that their cumulative number of attempts and at then, more than 12. So I don't know if that met, like, is he he's proud of stats. That? I mean,
it's just like, it's a weird narcissistic power trip with, like, you know, lying and all this stuff. Again, he's studying, he probably knows about the bite, you know, he probably had a checklist.
Yeah, he probably studied it. Now, unfortunately, on top of all of this other nightmare scenario, it looked like Claudia, her parents separated in 2013, a lot of it because of Larry. And her mother eventually moved out of hotels. So Claudia started living in hotels, which, by the way, at this point, Claudia was, Larry had started essentially accusing Claudia of poisoning or trying to attempt to poison him and Talia. And she was so, and she, and released that video, and she essentially admitted that she was trying to poison them. She started, working as an escort in 2014 under the nom de guerre, which is a combination of Larry's daughter's names. And she essentially, she had a website, and she advertised services for $8,000 a night. And she would give all of her profits to Larry in order to pay for the damage she believed she'd done in North Carolina. And in the trial, it estimated that she probably gave him $1.5 million from escorting, which, again, there is... I just hope he gets so destroyed in prison. I don't know. But again, with people who are such master manipulators, it's probably not going to happen because...
You never know. I mean, you know, like, you know, they may not be under, you know, 15 years old, but nonetheless, you know, you still, there's still, you're marked. These were kids. You know, at the end of the day, they're still underage.
Yeah. And it, yeah. Well, they're still underage. Well, underage, right, not by right, the government, right, but in brain development. So finally, Isabella, Felicia, and Larry continued to live in the apartment on 93rd Street. Santos and Lisa came regularly, but Larry Chen finally was like, all right, I am done with all of this. Yeah. And he evicted Larry in 2014, and he claimed that he was becoming increasingly disturbed by Larry's treatment of the young adults in the apartment, and also like what the fuck is going on with all of these renovations. Now, Larry, of course, countersued Shen, and he listed Felicia, Isabella, and Talia as co-plaintiffs. And the trial went, the case went to trial in early 2015, and Claudia, Isabella, and Yalitza were witnesses. And this is again where the false memories come in, because Larry's attorney asked Glenn, Larry's attorney, Glenn Ripa, asked Claudia how long she knew Larry. And this is where the insanity, again, this is God knows what the hell he planted in these kids' heads. So she, this is a quote from that Cut article. Quote, the first time I heard his name mentioned was probably when I was 9 years old. And which, by the way, is completely not true. And over the course of her hour-long testimony, she laid out this elaborate conspiracy tracing back towards three generations of her family about essentially trying to get Larry for his involvement with Giuliani and Carrick, which again will go in next. We're bringing in Giuliani into this. There's even we'll get there next week. And that she had essentially, Claudia's mother had sent Claudia to Sarah Lawrence to, quote, hurt Larry and Talia. And so this is full on brainwashed memory implantation. I mean, it's, and she's, this is, by the way, in a court of law, under oath. Yeah. So she unfortunately
a little background as to how crazy, just a little. He said he always claimed that he was related to Al Capone. Okay. So that's pretty bonkers. He was actually born 1959, Bay Ridge, Brooklyn. His birth name was Greco, and he later changed it to his stepdad's last name. And, you know, his folks divorced. And so, you know, what's funny is, like, sometimes I'm thinking he's also taking his trauma emotions and his trauma and probably displacing a lot of that. You know, he probably had issues with his stepdad or with his dad. Who knows? I mean, maybe I'm reaching, but basically, everyone across the board said Larry Ray could be whoever you wanted him to be. That's how manipulative and how much of a chameleon he was, that he knew how to act with Giuliani. Then he knew how to act with someone like Daniel. I mean, it just goes back and forth. You don't even know who he is.
Back and forth. Exactly. Yeah, no, exactly. So Larry Chen won the eviction, but it took him another year to get him out of the apartment. And I think it's so long. So I think we didn't go over everything horrifying thing that happened to these children, but as you can get a pretty good sample, I mean, this was, a manipulative, abusive, violent, sexual cult of seven people. And next week, we will talk about who Larry is, his insane stories with he actually crossed paths with a lot of very famous people because he was this chameleon. And we'll get into whatever what happened in the trial. So hopefully this will be two episodes. Maybe it'll be three if we need to do a third episode on the trial. But I hopefully feel
like
we'll
Johnny
do it
Ray has like dashes of Epstein. in him. Larry Ray, I'm sorry.
You mean Larry Ray?
Has little dashes yeah. of that Jeffrey Epstein, I have this over you, I have ultimate power, I can get these girls to prostitute and do anything. There's like, there's something along, yeah. I don't know, and I just can't explain it. And I also do think, in a way, it is creepier that it's not your typical huge cult. That it's a small organized group, I find a little more intimidating and creeped out by.
Right. And how easily, you know, you could, again, in a very vulnerable time in your life, fall into something like this. And God forbid you fall across a path of one of these kinds of people, because, I mean, it took years for some of these kids to get deprogrammed. And some of them are still, obviously, Isabella never got deprogrammed. She's going to jail.
The Santos kids all got back together and they're with their family. So that's, you know.
Yeah. But I mean, look at the they didn't die, but look at the havoc that happened to them and to their parents and for the rest of their lives. It's the mind control stuff scares the crap out of me, because our brains are so malleable to be able to essentially put a program into your head. So like brainwash you and then stick in false memories, and to essentially believe that three generations of your family was after this one guy, Larry Ray, and like how your brain kind of twisted that story around into truth, that you would actually go into a court of law under, you know, the threats of perjury to like tell this insane non-reality story. It's just, to me, it's brain hacking. Yeah. Somebody's brain, which is again, the BITE model, which was a very fascinating reading.
Explains because
again, the Russians.
I'm curious to know, was this premeditated? Did he know that there was opportunity to do this in living with them? Hopefully maybe it was Talia who gave him the idea to move in. Maybe he did it. Like, I'm just curious to know if he thought about this before it actually happened.
Well, because I'm wondering if this is just the way he goes through life. Like, he's like, oh, I need a place to live. I'm going to go live in this dorm room. And here's like an 18-year-old that I want to have sex with. All right. How am I going to get her to have sex with me? All right. I can totally take advantage of her. Oh, and here's this other person. And there is, when I was doing research on him, there is a thing about him, again, like being attracted to powerful people. And Felicia was a powerful, I mean, she's like a Harvard grad going to be a doctor from Columbia. Like, this is a powerful, intellectual young woman. And like, for him, who is so deviant and gross, being like, how can I destroy that? Can I destroy that? Can I figure out how to like get under her skin? And like, this is like, almost like a challenge, right? So, we can definitely discuss that next week, because we're going to go all through who exactly this guy was with all of his crazy ass stories, and gloat and be happy with the fact that he got 60 years. He's never coming out of jail, and hopefully bad things are done to him. anyone, but oh my God. Anyway, so thank you for joining us. Happy St. Patrick's Day, and tune in to us next time when we do part two of Freak Show Larry Ray. All right, have a good day, everybody. This episode was sponsored by The Creek Killer, book one in the Harriet Harper thriller series written by me, Dominika Best. What would you do if you read the police found your body in a creek? Find out in The Creek Killer, available on Amazon. Thank you for joining me and listening to this episode. If you like my show, please give me a rating and review. It helps other listeners find this podcast. Follow Dominika Best Presents The Deviant Mind wherever you listen to your podcasts. Visit thebeststorytellingnetwork.com, where you'll find show notes, my books, links to social media, and much more. Join my Patreon for special subscriber perks, like 2 extra exclusive episodes a month and a Q&A with me at patreon.com/thedeviantmindpodcast. Until next time.